Daniel, it's okay. You can take the mask now.
Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. Hey, guys, welcome. We're here once again. Daniel, Tom, and Eden, Middle Eastern hipsters, just three Israelis that talk about shit that matters.
Hey,
how
guys.
Are you guys doing?
Oh, how's it going? I missed you all. It's
holy
good to see you.
Bananas.
Mamash bananas.
Holy cannoli.
Holy shit. How long haven't we seen each other for?
First of all, it's not that we haven't seen each other so long. We see you now in your apartment. So thank you for hosting us, Daniel.
Yeah, we changed the atmosphere a little bit.
Can you tell everyone why?
More homey, more cozy. Yeah, because the air conditioner doesn't work where we usually record at the moment. And it's impossible.
Just for the record, I just got back from the beach. So I'm still with my bathing suit and some sand on. And I feel really bad for filling your house with a lot of sand right now.
Well, you should feel bad for my girlfriend.
Yes.
Anyway.
I kind of shook off.
No, but for both of us, everything. Honestly.
But it's nice weather for Israeli summer so far. 27 degrees? Not too bad,
but you still can't sit, you know. With no air conditioner.
No, that's
absolutely impossible. But yeah, how are you guys doing? How did you spend your? So we obviously have a pandemic going on.
Yes.
Obviously, I mean it's what everybody
talks
about.
Also here, really, it got here.
I mean, yeah, in our little corner, godforsaken land in the Middle East.
Our God-given land.
God-given land in the Middle East.
Wait, so you have your own business. How was it for you during Corona time?
Not too bad. You know, for digital businesses, so I'm a graphic designer, so for digital businesses, I just worked from home. I usually work from a co-working space. But I just moved to working from home. It wasn't that bad. I mean...
You thought it would be worse and it wasn't?
I thought it's going to be harder to concentrate at home and harder to actually get work done. But it wasn't, and I'm glad it wasn't. Now I feel more like it's easier for me now to work from home even when I can, you know,
go
back to the office. And sometimes I do that. In terms of like clients and stuff like that.
It's the same.
Pretty much the same.
But for you, Tom, it was a huge change because you have patients, right?
Yes, for dentists, it was not so good. The clinic had to be closed for a while. We could take first aids, like if you broke a tooth or you have pain or something like that, but all the treatments got postponed.
Right.
Yeah. But now it's really picking up again because everybody got postponed
like
and they want to get it over with.
Very problematic business to work in during a pandemic, you know, digging in people's mouths.
Yeah, we bought for the staff of the clinic, we bought like these crazy scrubs that are antimicrobial with antibacterial
stuff. It doesn't sound cool in any way.
It sounds
scary.
Man, it's cool. It's cool. Yeah.
So I worked from home as well. And at first, my organization that I work for is also mostly online. And so it wasn't a problem not to be physical in the office. But for me, it was like scary at first to start working from home because the first few weeks was like, where is the borders of home and work? When do I stop? Where do I sit? Like my lunch break and my work time looks the same and my after work hours looks the same. And I think the hardest things for me was not seeing my friends and family for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about probably how the lockdown came, you know, upon Israel and what it meant and stuff like that. But I discovered a whole new world of hobbies that I've never had time to do.
Oh, really?
And
like what?
I started a community garden in my building.
Nice.
Yeah.
Like in a kibbutz.
Actual hipster.
I grow now like all kinds of herbs and I grow flowers and I learned how to regrow all kind of really weird plants and
nice.
Yeah, you guys should check it out on my Instagram page. I upload the regular stories about my new babies. Each time it's a different seed that I grow. Yes, I'm
amazing.
An old lady deep down inside.
Yeah,
in my plants.
You just need some cats now.
Yeah, I saw a funny meme the other day.
Are you growing weed?
That's the base for everything, you know? I'm like A-B testing about all kinds of different plants.
Yeah,
and I'm just
course.
Checking, like, what's the requirements for
when the cups come by, it's, bro, I'm just A-B testing. Don't worry about
it. Don't worry.
I just want to see how these leaves react to the Israeli climate. That's all.
Wait,
that's
Tommy, all you also did something really cool.
First of all, I got in crazy good shape. Because I started a new workout regime.
Yeah, I lost a lot of weight too, which was surprising. Most of my friends just ate
gained,
all day,
right?
And I kind of lost it, which was good.
But I started actually a new lecture that I'm doing with on Ask Tom About Israel.
Mm-hmm.
What I noticed is that with my lectures so far and the talks that I'm giving, it's sometimes very difficult for Europeans or Americans or whatever to understand, first of all, the Israeli point of view on how this conflict is perceived. And
the Israeli Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yes, yeah, the Israeli-Palestinian, the Israeli-Arab conflict. Generally, how Israel
in general, I think, is hard to grasp sometimes.
Yeah, the mentality of Israelis, and also geopolitics, especially in the Middle East, like countries, you know, Turkey sending soldiers to Libya to fight with the Syrian militia. Like, what is happening around here? So, so I did a little talk with 40 students. I think most of them were from France. And I actually brought Eden with me also.
Yeah, I was on board. Was it a delightful moment to talk with you again?
It was good. Yeah, it was good. Really good. I like it. I like the vibe. And it actually, I expected it to be around 1 hour and it was like 2 hours and 15 minutes almost.
Oh my God, the questions were just mind-blowing. You know, what people are interested in and how they break down this complexity of Israel in general and ask the right questions in order to understand better. So it was really, really, really special, very interesting lecture that you did. Good job.
I was also very impressed with the questions and with your answers also.
I thought you were going to say, I'm also very impressed with the lecture. I was extremely impressed by myself.
I was like, wow, who is this genius and handsome fellow doing this? No, I'm kidding.
Wasn't you. I'm just joking. Yeah. Obviously. That's great, actually.
Because I'm handsome.
That's
so before we started recording, we actually had our own disagreement about a lot of things that happened here and the way that maybe the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like you're like pulling up your sleeves, Daniel,
Israelis disagreeing. What are you talking about?
Especially when it comes to the policy taken by the Israeli government when it came to how to handle the pandemic. Maybe we should start with a little bit of numbers of what happened here in the past few months. Another cool disclosure is that Tom and I were both on a ski trip together with a bunch of other friends when the pandemic has just started, I think, in Italy.
Yeah, I remember that. I can't believe they're actually going, like, traveling now.
No, it was like...
I was shocked about that.
I think it was like the beginning of March that we went, and the first case of corona happened when we were abroad, and when we came back, we had like 3 days in the office, and they shut down everything after. So we were like a fraction of a minute before everything just collapsed. So that was like our point of view of where it started, but for you, it was like a regular weekday, I guess.
I remember like the... So there was the Saturday. So here we started the week on Sunday, obviously, in Israel. We started our week on Sunday. So Saturday night was when they announced like the first lockdown, the first like limitation in terms of don't go to work and stuff like that. And I remember that Saturday I went to the museum with my mom just because we had Jeff Koons here.
If you know, he's still here.
The
show is still here.
Very mediocre.
Wow, really?
Great artist.
Oh my God,
we're
gonna get so many unfollows because of that.
Great artist. I mean, you need to like his style, but he's a very great artist. But the exhibition itself was very mediocre, like many art events here in Israel. But let's not go into something that's.
You're so critical.
We went to the museum.
It was in Tel Aviv Museum, and we went there, and after that we went to Brasserie, which is like a famous restaurant in Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
And that restaurant is actually closing because in the next few weeks, supposed that's what they're saying, in the next few weeks because of corona and many other issues. So it was amazing because it's like the end of a cycle or something, we closed like a full circle of like going into lockdown last time in the restaurant that we love so much is going to close down. And it's so funny. And then when I came home, and then while we were sitting there, we were like, is this like what's going on? Because it just started to look like we're talking about maybe early March.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like, we started like thinking about, wait, is this even okay that we are here? Is this, because everything was still like normal.
Just reminding you that we came back from the ski trip. You didn't want to meet us. Remember that?
Yeah.
And I could definitely understand why.
I think that was a little bit after they gave the first instructions. Yeah, I think it was like maybe a week after or something.
Yeah. Yes. And also because you are a hypochondriac.
Yeah.
How do you say it, Eden?
Sorry. Hypochondria. Daniel, hit us with numbers.
Health anxieties.
Hit us with numbers.
I have a few stats for you. Okay, so overall deaths in Israel since corona first arrived.
COVID-19 for those who are calling it in a different name.
Yeah.
314.
Cases. of death.
Yes.
Due to the virus.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which average is basically nothing. Which in terms is of like war
wait,
numbers.
Wait.
Which Americans we're listing now will be like, what the fuck? That's it.
Americans. Yeah.
But wait.
Also Italians.
We're gonna do the comparisons
Spanish
in a minute because I have a lot to say about comparisons.
Now we have
like
in the past 24 hours we had.
But wait, because don't talk about 24 hours. We had a peak, right? We had like the graph. Well, everyone is talking about lowering the graphs. That's what most countries are trying to do.
Yes.
Now Israel has already managed to get under under 8 cases a day. It was
yes
like a month ago.
Yes.
And whoever's listening now, today is what?
27?
June 27.
Uh-huh.
We are in the middle of the new wave. So it's really important to say that the 400 new cases in a new wave that is just starting now in Israel, because we already passed the first wave successfully.
Yes.
Yeah. And now we're going to talk about why our government is so stupid sometimes for not implementing policies.
Yes. So as Eden said, we have in the past 24 hours 400 new cases. But overall, recovered 16,872, which is,
how much overall cases?
Overall cases, I think we peaked at around 19,000 and we started going down.
Concurrent cases, overall cases, even people who...
Let me check that.
But it's really interesting. So that's been said. It's really interesting because Israel was one of the first countries to have the most severe policies around COVID-19 regulations. Before, in other places in the world, Israel locked their borders.
Yeah.
People have, you know, they stopped all kinds of services from public
transportation.
You got
transportation.
It.
Trains
and buses and stuff like that. Even going to office and stuff like that. So it was a big deal, and it cost us with a huge diplomatic crisis, because if you know, Israel choosing to lock borders with countries that are not locking borders, it has a lot of meaning and weight to it. So
and
that's
also
something should be said.
I actually have some stats. So so far in Israel, we had 22,800 people diagnosed with positive with corona.
That's half of a day of what's going on now in the States.
Like
2 days ago, they marked 40,000 cases a day.
Oh yes, and the active people sick people that we have right now, so not just people who are diagnosed but actually have symptoms, 5,614. Out of them, 46 are in a difficult condition and 28 are under a respiratory machine.
Right. So
which is
about
funny because it's less than the number of ministers we have in the government.
Oh my God. Well, bam, right?
Yeah.
That's
exactly
like
exactly.
So just to talk
screw
about
the corruption.
What was the scary part of the pandemic here in Israel and probably everywhere else is what not the number of deaths, but more of how could people be treated in hospitals, right? So the crisis was not enough VAPs, how do you say?
Not enough masks or not enough respiratory machines?
Respiratory machines,
yes,
exactly that. Which was the scary part for the system, because it said we don't want to be in an overload situation, almost like what happened in Italy, where they had to choose who to save and who not. So the Israeli policy was pushing towards lowering the graph in order to have enough hands, machines, space in hospitals to treat people who are coming in.
Yeah, but I have to say, because this actually really bothered me throughout this time, the media has been really pumping up the fear. And
right.
I think also the government, when they come out with declarations like I have here right now, 19-year-old dies of corona. You're thinking, oh my God, she's just 19. How did she die? How is this possible? And then when you read a little bit about it, you see that she had some severe medical conditions. So
regardless to the virus.
Yeah, like technically she could have died any day and she also happened to get corona and then die.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because you're a medical official.
He's a doctor, you can say.
He's
a dentist. My wife is a doctor.
And you're a dentist.
Yeah.
And so how do you feel, like, do you feel that the severe lockdown that we started with that happened here during March, April, a little bit into May even, do you think it was justified? Do you think it was pumped up by media? Do you think...
Can you give a word about a lockdown? Like, because maybe for different places in the world,
so
lockdown
is different. I would say, you know, the terms changed during, but generally people didn't go to work. Many people got released. I mean, I would say get fired temporarily. Yeah. So they were like
release leave or
yeah,
like
they got a unpaid vacation.
Unpaid vacation.
Which is basically get fired temporarily, and and yeah, there was some times where you could like leave the house just to I don't know work out or go to jog. And
so the limitations
some,
generally.
Sometimes
right.
At some periods you couldn't like go further than 100 meters away from your house.
So that was the peak of it, right?
Yeah, that was the peak.
And I think that we were like that. Well, the government was very lucky, or the policymakers were very lucky, because a lot of those lockdowns happened during really big holidays, Jewish holidays in, mm-hmm. in Israel,
yeah.
that people were already out of work. Transportation wouldn't work anyway, so a lot of businesses were supposed to be closed for the holiday, and they used that to create a huge lockdown that people literally couldn't leave the house. And when I say mm-hmm. couldn't leave the house, you could only get food and medicine, and for another than that, you wouldn't be able to leave, like you said, 100 meters out
yeah.
of your house.
Yeah.
For exercise, I used to run on the parking lot in circles.
Yep.
I did like
I heard
5 kilometers in there, running in a circle.
Absolutely. I heard many people that did that. I was really following the members of our parliament who were trying to get a permit for the citizens to do workouts and things like that, because it's something that I really care about. In my personal opinion, I think that our government was afraid. They were not sure what we are dealing with, because a lot of the information that is coming out of China turned out to be unreliable.
Not even China, but also Italy, which is not even a comparable. It's a lot of it is not comparable to what's going here. So the numbers were just like flowing in the air, and
yeah,
couldn't really
and I think they panicked. And they did a total shutdown. And yes, it saved lives, but also we have almost 1 million unemployed people in Israel right now.
The highest number was 25% unemployed.
Something like that, 25% unemployed.
Out of 9 million people. Total.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a lot.
So you would think, so even though you see the results were good until we got to the second wave, which we have now, but let's say compared to a few weeks ago, even though the results were good, you think that the response was too harsh?
In my personal opinion, I mean, it's always easy to look, you know, in retrospective and just say, yeah, it was too much too little.
In retrospect, considering the results.
I think it was too much. I think that, yes, it's important to save lives, but how many people lost their jobs? How many people don't have an income now? How many people have no food at home because they just ran out of their savings?
We're going to talk about it in a minute, but it's interesting to say that maybe it's worth mentioning that I think the major conflict for this decision to lock down or not lock down, shut down the whole economical, you know, wheel of an industry of this country, was the battle between health and economy, right?
Yes.
What are you saving more, people's lives or people's job? We could recover or are we willing to pay the price? People can't see me, but I'm doing like with my finger price.
Quotation marks.
Price of death, which was, by the way, Britain's approach at first.
Yeah, and Sweden's.
And Sweden's as well. And they're not all of them are in good numbers now.
No,
like Denmark.
Sweden is doing terrible. Denmark
really
is doing
bad.
Good, actually.
And or saying we are shutting down, you know, the economy in total just to make sure that we're not losing lives. And it's a battle that I think also in the media and also in the policymakers who had to lead an agenda. It was a very, very, very media even a conflict, because you could see the battles between the heads of the ministers. Like they really mm-hmm. had to make decisions that were critical, and the they were prices from both ends. I think more in the economy side, we can feel the prices
yes,
now.
Yes, absolutely.
So before we talk about the economy price, let's stay in the health issue just for one more question, because
yeah.
is this... So you say that you think it was too harsh, and Eden, do you agree? You think it was too harsh as well?
I don't know if the answer would be yes. My feeling is that it was harsh, not proportioned to the numbers in our geographical area. And I'll explain. Look, 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 look. Can you hear it?
Everybody can hear it.
If you look at the numbers of what happened in the Middle East in general, the numbers were very low. Even if we take in consideration that some of the numbers are a bit like, you know, being edited or not completely true.
By crazy dictators around us, yes.
Yes, but like, you know, like Jordan said, 90 cases of coronavirus. Okay, makes no sense, right? But it's not 90,000. Like even if they took a few zeros down, it's not 90,000. We would know of something like that. So if you look and zoom out of the whole region, you're saying, wait a minute. So it's like, it's not like Europe. It's not like the States. Maybe it's a climate changes that is different here. Maybe it's genetics of people who live here. Maybe it's a different immune system.
I think it's
system.
Just a smaller place. There's less people. If you can compare a city like Tel Aviv expect, to though, London or New York or Paris in terms of like transportation, public transportation, in terms of how many people are for square meter or square feet.
Yeah, whatever. But you would expect that if you have an outbreak in a small place, would still be like the percentage would still be very, very high. Okay, like it's still a number.
The thing is with Israel specifically with the death rates, you have to remember that Israel has a very young population. So 45% of the population in Israel is 25 or under. And most of these people don't really feel the effects of that disease. Unless
that
they have
would be the approach
conditions.
Of England, right? That would be the approach of
well, in England they don't have, but in England most of the people they have there are not 25 or under. They're actually right. Much older. Also in Sweden, and if you check, a lot of the cases that died, and it is really unfortunate in Israel. I think the average age of death was 82. Years old.
Yes, it's very old. Yes,
so that's quite
that's very
old.
Old.
So,
yeah.
So if we're like you think that if we handle like we are now, which is a lot more open, right? Now everything is open. People can go anywhere. The only limitation is basically you have to go with the mask.
Yeah, but it's not the only limitation
when you're in a public
because
space.
It's not the only limitation because the approach now is treating red zones, specific zones. That
yeah,
have
they
a
lock
higher
down. Yeah.
Lockdown on
specific,
zones that they have higher rate of cases or stuff like
but
that.
You think that
and you know what? That would be a better approach to start with.
You think it would?
Yes, absolutely. I think
that's
that shutting down a whole the state said the same thing. Okay, if you have in the desert a small community of 70 people living there, they don't need to stop going to work. If they don't have one case of corona,
true, but Israel is
in
very
200
different.
Kilometers
we don't have
around them,
places
okay?
that are that secluded. The country is pretty small. Only maybe in the desert, there's more secluded places, but these places aren't like a big part of the workforce anyway. So
true, but even if you look at the map,
if
you're looking at the map of Israel when the outbreak started, you could still border it in specific areas of red zones.
Yes, that's true.
Not all spread it. And the way to deal with it and to at least gradually use it in different system of saying, okay, wait a minute, this is an area that is very hot and very like a contagious and dangerous for the whole economy, then we will treat that first and then, you know, apply it on all
well,
the
where
state.
Would you think we would be right
so,
now if we started with that approach?
Well, I'll tell you, actually, we already started. There is one Arab town called Al-Ara where they put heavier restrictions.
In the Negev or in the
no,
center?
It's in the north.
Then it's next to my house.
It's in the
really?
No, not where I live now, next to my parents' house.
So there. And also in Bat Yam and Ashdod, I believe. So just
Ashdod is a very, very big city.
Yeah,
it's
big city in the south.
It's one of the biggest cities, maybe the fourth biggest.
Bat Yam is a city next to Tel Aviv.
Yeah, it's
but
in the center, but it's smaller.
Look, I'll give you an example from the previous wave that we had. So the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel, they live in mostly in specific areas. Mm-hmm. And one of them is called Bnei Brak.
Very, very close, like literally locked communities which create cases in the community, as we
yes.
say.
Yes, and what happened...
As well.
Yeah, right, so, and what happened was that when the... virus started spreading, what the health ministry noticed is that a lot of the cases are ultra-Orthodox people. And so they tested... random people in the street in these areas. And what they found that in Bnei Brak, almost every third person was diagnosed positive. So they put the city under total lockdown with, you know, army and police
right.
and everything.
Exactly.
But, I mean, army
uh-huh.
not to
it's
keep
true.
The people in the home, but just to, you know, make sure that everything is in order and no one is violating
not
any rules.
Not only that, the army provide meals and food and medical care, which is
yes.
very, very important to say because
yes.
the army has done a word about the army during the pandemic, which
yeah.
is really interesting because... For the first time in the history of Israel, when a crisis occurs, it's not the army leading the situation. they were a player as anyone else in this situation and not a leading one, and it caused a lot of confusion even in that system, because they used to be the ones who are leading the, you know, the head, yes, of solutions, yeah, of crisis.
Yeah, because they have the best people and the best budget.
So they use
the biggest they have the biggest ability to execute. Yeah. They can execute plans really easily, and because they have manpower and the systems that you need to execute plans.
True.
And another thing about that is that smartly they use the manpower and the facilities the army has, not in the use of military use, but more of a civil use. They use soldier to give away meals for people who are locked down in homes. They use soldier to allow people or to escort them to the hospital. They use the manpower in order to deal with that pandemic.
Yes, and which is interesting. And that actually worked fantastically. I mean, I have to say it, as much as I disagree with the ultra-Orthodox politics that, mm-hmm, we have in the country, I actually have a lot of respect for the way the rabbis realized the mistake that they made, yeah, with disrespecting what the government said and corrected it. And
I don't know if you noticed, but ultra-Orthodox people walking down the street always, always, always wear masks.
Always.
I don't live around enough ultra-Orthodox.
Yeah, so here in where I live, there's quite a lot of them. Yeah. And I've been to the DMV, whatever, who is very, it's very, very close to Bnei Brak, the city we're talking about. And there's a lot of ultra-Orthodox people coming there, and they all wear masks.
Yep.
And
yep,
they, it seems like they take it more seriously.
Right. Yes. I think it's worth saying why the cases in those communities are higher. And it's really important because it's also happening in the States. And by the way, lack of knowledge and ignorance about this topic leads to a lot of anti-Semitic, I'm laughing because we talked about it last episode, but about, it leads to a lot of anti-Semitic approaches of the Jews starting the you know, pandemic and stuff, yeah, like, yeah, that. The reason that the cases in those communities are higher is because of a few things. First of all, a lot of them have a lot of kids. Big families, like on average between 8 to 12 kids living in a two-bedroom apartment, okay? It's a lot of kids. It's a lot of members. All, each one of that kids is going to a different system or program, yeah, or stuff like that. Add to that religious rituals, going to synagogues 3 times a day, meeting in prayers, having big dinners. The whole community life is around people and a lot, yeah, of them, and in places that sanitaric issues are not the main thing in their mind most, yeah, of the time. So
also living conditions.
Living condition,
they
absolutely.
They live in generally big families in small apartments, right?
Add to that, to those, that those communities are following religious leaders, not policymakers, not government officials, yeah, not laws of the states. They have rabbis or leaders who are saying, this is what you're doing. And unless we have a good communication with those leaders, things go very slowly or not going at all. So just a word about why the numbers there were higher. They were, how do you say, like a... Never mind, I lost my word. Go ahead.
You lost your word?
So we're saying basically, we're basically saying that that you think a lockdown on certain specific places, like ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods or other places who has high... high cases rating, you think that should be the original,
yes, so,
approach.
Yeah, and I understand why when we didn't know a lot about the virus, we took a much harsher approach. I, mm-hmm, think the way to handle it now, especially with the regrowth of our economy, because it took quite a lot of people took quite a hit, and I think it's important to get out of it as fast as we can so we can keep growing the market, the Israeli market, which is doing quite a good job until the corona. I think it's important that we understand this is not going anywhere. We're going to have to learn to deal with it.
Right.
So
I have, yeah, two thoughts about the success of Israel. Okay, I'm calling it success because it was a success in a lot of levels.
Absolutely.
It was a success of overcoming the pandemic. Kind of funny saying it that we're in the middle of a second wave, but it was. And then we'll talk about how not a smart government we have for not applying policies and kind of sticking with it. But Israel was announced to be the safest place in the world during the pandemic, which is interesting because then I ask questions. Is it because we are very, very well-behaved citizens and we're doing what we're told?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Or, which what I think, is we are very... We are a nation that is very used to emergencies, and we act fast. adding that we have a lot of initiative approaches to a lot of things, and we can see it throughout all the sectors, like through business sector, health sector, the army, like I said, and so on.
Absolutely. I think that Israelis are highly creative people. I think they are used to thinking outside the box. Mm-hmm. So just a few startups that I collected. It's actually with there was a TV show and they interviewed Erel Margalit, the head of JVP, mm-hmm. which is not Jewish Voice for Peace.
Right, no.
Jerusalem
venture something. Right.
Yeah, damn it, I'll look it up soon. But anyway, the guy's a genius. I really love him. And so, for example, there was an Israeli company that managed to basically build a small hospital in containers that could be driven by trucks.
Smart.
And so you can bring a hospital somewhere if you need it right now, handle everything, pack it up and leave mm-hmm. after. A little robot that you can communicate with your doctor through on a screen, and you can program the robot to bring you the medication you need, cool. feed your dog even, things like that. It was really cool. There was, you know, I don't know if you have this where you guys are, but in Israel now, when you are entering a place like a restaurant or whatever, then they measure your fever in the entrance, your temperature. And so, so they invented a machine that can do that with in less than 1 second, and it's a very accurate temperature. So it was really cool.
I really enjoyed it. To see how in one nation we had a lot of problem solvers. I actually led a few webinars of COVID-19 solutions. I focused on the civic ones, not the governmental ones or business ones, but it was really interesting to see a lot of civil society's solutions for COVID-19. A really fun one is a mask for people who are deaf. They can't hear, but they're reading lips. And what happened if you use a mask and you can't read lips? So they see-through mask for people with hearing problems. I don't know what's a PC word for
hearing disabilities.
Hearing disabilities. Thank you.
But we don't like PC words. I mean, I don't like them. So
in general, if we're kind of summarizing this topic, right? The discussion now in Israel in the public area is more about, I call it a very Israeli approach. Look at us, we defeated the war, we were so great, we didn't learn anything from it, but we won, okay? Yeah. So it's a very, the moral of the story is we always win and we never learn from it. And now we're in a second wave, and if we're not going to be smart again really fast, we're going to go downhill. And I'm annoyed with a lot of things that, it's a social care a country, right? We are paying every month a lot of money to social care, and a lot of businesses, you are an independent business, so you can talk about that as well.
Haven't really had
the support they should have got from the state.
No.
If we're talking about the economic situation, really, it's not great. But I would say this. I would say people who get laid off, at least, even if it's temporarily, they get money from the country, right? They get unemployment from the country. Not a lot, but it's something. Also, we know about a lot of people who, and I'm not here defending the country, I'm just I think that there's a general expectation of people here in Israel, mostly business owners, but not just, they basically expect the government to take care of all their issues. Mm-hmm. And I get it that it's an approach. Some people get it. Some people has this approach. Some people, that's what they want. But I don't think it's reasonable to expect that. I don't think it's reasonable to expect that you'll get something extra over what anyone gets, which is like the unemployment salary or
this
pay.
This is what happened in the States, which is one of the most capitalist approach in the world, right? The minute the pandemic started there and they understood that they're going to get into an economic situation and a problem, each citizen got $100,000, $200 check from the government.
$100,000?
No.
$1,200.
But this is about... This is,
without having a business.
$1,200 is about a 1 month pay for...
but it's done unemployment. Fast. It's done systematically. It's done fast. It's not a social care state.
It's done here as well. It's done here fast as well, because as soon as these people laid off.
But not for all citizens.
Okay, so we can talk about business owners, right? That's a different story. Business owners, they got some money, but they got around 1 month pay of what a normal employee would get, right? And I mean, you could say that it's not enough, and it's not enough, all right? Mm-hmm. But you could also say that as business owners who are independent, who own their own business, who are in charge of their own financial fate at every point of time, right? Not just during the pandemic. As a business owner, you're always in charge. You're always solely in charge of your financial fate, of the success of your business.
True.
So suddenly now they expect all the problems to be solved by the government. And hold on 1 second. And especially when there's so many other things you could do, right? Some people. There's a story about a famous actor here in Israel, very famous, successful actor, who went to work as
in a grocery shop.
Yeah, in a grocery shop selling vegetables and fruit because you know, carrying crates and stuff like that, because that's what he could do at the time, and he decided that it's better, and it's he's like one example because he's famous, so people know him, right? So they did a story about him in the news. But there's a lot of things you can do for yourself to help yourself in this tough time, and expecting all your and doing none of these things while expecting that the government will take care of you magically is just not. I don't think it's a viable solution. I don't think it's fair to expect.
I agree.
And I think it's a very unresponsible approach for someone who's a business owner.
I agree, and I think what this taught a lot of people is that first of all that they're paying way too much tax compared to what they're actually getting.
But that's a problem. And it's not. It's disagreeing with what Daniel just said. Because
no.
If we pay so much tax and we don't get anything in return, then it's not about what you mean.
Don't get anything in return. There's an army that guards the borders. They need to get paid.
No, but there's like but hold on. There's not
there's highways.
Guys,
there's highways wait. Being built. There's things happening around us. We allow it by paying taxes.
I think that what it will teach a lot of Israelis is that. They are paying high taxes, but it doesn't always go to where they want it to go. And also, it's going to teach a lot of business owners that they need to start saving more. How that will affect the economy, I don't know, but that's what I think is happening right now.
I agree. I think, first of all, I want to make a correction about what I just said before. Taxes and social care are not the same thing, okay? Yeah. We pay social care for dark days. These are dark days. And we pay the minute we start working, right? The minute we start working or the minute we get any kind of salary, we put aside an amount in order to make sure that when a dark day arrives, we will be secured because we put that money away. The amount that people got back compared to the dark day length of time is not equivalent, is not a proportion to what they need right now. Now, I could agree with you on the criticism of how people manage their own financial life. There's no way that 1 month would make people collapse. If they are smart financially, right, running their, you know, household, business hold, whatever they're doing, 1 month shouldn't wreck a ship. Shouldn't happen. You're right. Second thing that I want to add is to what Tom said about it will teach business owners to save more. It's not only to save more, it's to be creative more. Because the idea is not only how to, you know, save money for a dark day, but it's how to keep on getting money in a dark day. And there are some fields that could do and move online and be creativity or even change the field of work. And some can't.
It's true that some can, but everyone can take some sort of action. Look, my father, for example, he's a business consultant, and he during this time he didn't have any new clients, and he wasn't eligible to any sort of like
social security.
Yeah, any like payment from the government, and he used that time to create an online course of like 70 hours long online course, which he can now sell for. Thousand of
smart
local currency.
Smart yeah. kid. Yeah. smart yeah. man.
And you know why? Because your dad is one of the coolest people I know, man. I really love him. I always told Daniel, if your dad was our age, he would have been like a better friend of mine than you would. No, I'm kidding. But I would love you both equally.
Yeah, but that's just one example, right? So again, if you want to go out and shout in the street and protest, it's fine. It's your right. I think you should use your time as a business owner who needs to be responsible for his own fate, because you chose the independent way. You chose to be free, right? You're in charge of your own fate. You're free. And so I think that as someone who is who chose that way, you should show more responsibility to your own fate.
Agreed, in a way. Never mind. Okay.
Never mind.
Move on. Let's
agree,
move on.
Agreed, but I disagree, but no time, so...
yes. So two major things are happening in 2020 so far, right? So we had a huge pandemic and the States...
And the Olympics. The Olympics got canceled?
Oh, yeah. That,
didn't that what you want to say?
That's peanuts.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about the Olympics.
Wait, didn't a Justin Bieber concert get canceled? Oh, my God.
No.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so many things happen. But 2020 is like people said, it's the end of the world as we see it, as we know it. It's
yeah.
Can you put it in the track later when
maybe,
you edit it?
Maybe copyrighted, I don't know.
It's the end of the world. Anyway,
yes.
It's interesting. What is the end of the world mean? Because we see a pandemic that is shutting down economies and countries and yeah. movement and mobilization of people.
Yeah.
And then we see a society crisis, what's happening now in the States with the whole awareness of Black Lives Matter movement and it's literally going on flames, like literally, like it's not even a way of speaking, like things there are
like
going
literally on like flames.
Literally on flames. Your thoughts?
I'm gonna start here, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
I apologize to you and to the Black community, but since I'm not American, and since even though it's obviously an immensely important issue worldwide. Globally, racism and police brutality and all these kind of issues. I'm not gonna talk about BLM.
Okay.
I'm gonna talk about ALM. And ALM, it's not All Lives Matters. It's Arab Lives Matters. And the reason I want to talk about it is because here in Israel, we're Israelis, and I believe that we should be more involved in our local issues.
Mm-hmm.
And not just keep an eye on what's going on outside Israel, which is obviously important, but it's important worldwide. Again, not just to Americans, but I do want to talk about our local issues, and I think maybe this is why people won't want to are listening to this podcast, because we talk about things that happen here and might be relevant for them, or this, it's like a different point of view.
Okay, let's talk about it.
And I'm saying Arab Lives Matters. I'm not talking about Palestinians. I'm talking about Israeli citizens, like all of us. Who are not Jewish, who are Arab, and there are a lot of them here in Israel.
20%,
yes. Which I believe, and this is my opening statement, you would say, I believe are harshly mistreated by police. I believe they're victims of incredible racism,
mm-hmm.
Not just from the police force, but this is one issue. And I would give two quick examples to that. One... It might sound weird, but this is my personal example. There are, I'm going to start with the general example.
Okay.
There was a story recently in the radio that there was an Israeli diplomat who is Arab, and
he's a diplomat. He's working for the government.
He's yeah. working for the Foreign Affairs Ministry. And he just got brutally and violently arrested, or I mean, he wasn't arrested, but detained, you could say, because he went to the central bus station in Jerusalem, and when you enter, because Jerusalem is a problematic city, and there's a big history of terrorist attack in that specific location years ago, but still, there's like machines, the security machines. When you enter, not everybody goes through them. You go through them if you're asked to. And he's an Arab, so he obviously got asked to. And he didn't have his diplomat card ID, which he usually can show that he's a diplomat, and then they let him through. But he didn't have it at that specific day. And he was asked to go there. He filmed the process. He filmed the security check, which he's generally allowed to do. The details were that one security guard was okay with it, and he said, yeah, you can film. The other guy was not okay. The guy, the diplomat itself, said that he's filming in order to show people outside of Israel how things work here, like we do, right? But he wanted to show them how not necessarily I'm an Arab, they're checking just me, but look, this is what's going on when you want to enter the central bus station in Israel, because it's interesting for people who aren't used to this kind of security checks. And they decided that the security guards there decided that he's trying to encourage some kind of provocation or something like that, and they brutally arrest him and detained him, pushed him against the ground, and all these kind of things. And look, I don't know. I mean, Would they do it to would he do it if they know he's a diplomat? Probably
would
not.
Would they do it
to a Jewish person? Probably not.
Would they do it if we didn't have a security issue?
Okay, so here's
no, seriously.
So here there's another point of view who might make our situation, not might, it makes our situation different from the BLM situation.
Seriously, I'm going to be very harsh here. It's going to make the situation uncomparable. It's two different problems, and I'm going to address each one of them as a problem, but they're uncomparable because when you have a physical threat of terror, organized terror by one population against the other, not all Arabs, obviously, but it's a very, very tensioned country with a tensioned politics that has terror involved in it. We don't have to remember, we all remember what happened here during the years 2000, that buses are blowing in the air and civilians are dying because other civilians don't agree with them politically wise. Yes, we have a situation of terror. In it, we have a problem of racism. And whatever we're comparing it to, what happening in the States right now or in other countries where Black Lives Matter, they do, okay? It's about racism and police brutality. It's two different topics. And we can definitely talk in the range of how do you enforce or reinforce arrests not in a racist way in a country you have a terror. But we have terror here, a lot of it.
So I think it's also really important that, I mean, I don't know on the radio, but it seems like they just interviewed him. And he told his story, but we don't actually know what happened.
Second, I would add to your story. Sorry, Tom, for interrupting for a second.
It's fine.
Imagine this situation. Someone is asked to go through a security device. Okay? He's a part of a population that is suspected immediately. Right. This is wrong to do that, but they suspect him. And then he started to film the way of security check. The three of us could definitely think of other reasons why would someone start filming a security check. It's not that absurd that they would stop him for that. I'm sorry. I don't agree that it should be.
Also, wait, Eden. It's possible that they made a big mistake and that they shouldn't have done that.
In the reaction of how brutal approach shouldn't be there, you are right. But for them saying, hey, dude, take off the camera, maybe it's not okay. No. I agree.
Look, that's the problem is the reaction, because there wouldn't have been, he's completely fine with it. According to what he said in radio, he was fine with it that he was being asked to go through the security check. It makes sense. People get it. Mm-hmm. Arabs that go and they fly, they enter public places. They are aware of it. They know how it is. And I think that generally it's not nice. It's not a good life to live, but they understand it to some extent. This is not the point. The point is that he was harshly dealt unjustifiably. He was just he was dealt with extreme violence where another citizen wouldn't have. Now, can you say that this guy, can you say that they were doing it to stop him from some sort of like a terrorist attack? This is nuance. It's hard to say. We weren't there. It's
why
just
do you
a story.
Think it's happening? Seriously. Why?
I think it's happening because of racism. I think it's happening. Okay. I think it's happening because...
So it's not a policy. Let's make it on the table. It's not a policy to be brutal against Arabs in Israel.
Does the police in the United States have a policy of killing Black people?
I don't know. I'm
no,
not there.
They don't have... They obviously don't. But it's the people that are inside the force who have prejudice, or they have this kind of opinions or certain opinions on the minority population, mm-hmm. that makes them do these kind of things to Black people while they don't do the same things to white people.
Well,
and you have the examples of white people who did serious crimes, who are arrested on scene and are dealt with more lenience than a black guy or girl would have in a much less threatening situation.
Yeah.
I would think it's happening because we were accustomed to fearing Arabs here in Israel.
I have to say, I think, okay, first of all, listen, is there racism in Israel? Yes. Mm-hmm. 100%. Like you can't just wash it away, you know? Yeah, it exists.
Institutionalized racism.
Not just
racism, institutionalized racism.
I don't think that there is.
The US.
No, I don't think that there is institutionalized racism. I don't think there are
in some
laws.
Aspect, there are.
I don't think there are laws in Israel that are stopping Arabs from thriving in Israel. If anything, I know that, okay, for example, when you go to med school in Israel or other fields, a certain amount of seats has to be reserved for Arab students. Okay.
Custom so discrimination. I forgot.
I forgot what it's called.
Why
but they're
we
basically
only
trying to correct.
No way.
Yeah, they're trying to correct racism.
To give us
a but okay, I'll give you another example. There was a Palestinian man, okay, that in Jerusalem that the police asked him to stop. He started running away. Then the police chased him, and then the versions split. The commander said he told the soldiers not to shoot. The soldier said that the commander told him to shoot, and they killed the guy. And then turns out that the guy has special needs.
Yeah.
And he was just afraid of the police, and he ran away. All right. Now, is that bad? Absolutely, 100%. I don't think anyone in Israel would say no. That's totally justified, and it's cool. You know, but. Is it a policy that we shoot people with special needs? Absolutely not. And are these policemen and soldiers are now being investigated? Absolutely.
Are we talking about a policy written in stone? Like, yeah, it's not. It's not written anywhere. Probably, it's not. It doesn't say anywhere that you should.
Maybe it's written in blood.
That when you see an Arab or you see, I'm not talking about specific about Palestinian because the situation in Palestinian territory is different. There's more. I'm not saying they deserve less respect. Of course not, as people. Of course not. But the situation is inherently different because there's a lot of tension and a lot of security.
Also, they're not Israeli citizens. They're not Israeli citizens,
yes,
which is automatically different.
Which again doesn't mean that they deserve less respect. Obviously,
no. It's a different system.
It means that it's a different situation to the situation of
they're dealing with the army, not
the
police.
In the U.S., I'm comparing the situation with Arabs here to the situation of black people in the U.S. because these are Israeli citizens who live here who are. A minority and who are mistreated constantly because of racism.
As the Ethiopian community, and this is very
true.
Important to say.
This is also an important issue, and that one is 100% exactly the same as in the U.S. because we're talking about black people here in Israel who are also mistreated.
I'll tell you what, Daniel. I in my core of me, of Eden, living, growing up in Israel, I agree with every word you're saying. But now I'm not only Eden that, you know, grew up here. I'm also talking to people that I don't know where they're from. I don't know what they know about us. I don't know what they know about me. I don't know about what they know about the policy and stuff like that for Israel. And I would say this. We have to differentiate between racism in a cultural racism and policy racism. And we said it like in between the lines here. But there is no racism policy. It's not an apartheid state. It's not a place that discriminates
people.
Yeah,
but there's no racism policy in the U.S.
No,
as well.
Wait. Daniel,
and
but listen,
it's still,
Daniel.
It's still harsh enough to get hundreds of thousands, millions of people outside to the street.
You are right.
Okay.
Because it crossed the border, and maybe one day it will happen here as well, which it did. Reminding you, Ethiopian
demonstrations. It would never happen towards the Arab population.
You don't know that. You know, I'm really
Jewish Israelis would never protest because of police brutality against the Arab population because of the security and the security issue.
You know what?
And I guess it makes sense, but it still hurts.
No, I disagree with you. I don't think that they would never do it. I think that you are taking this in a way of, oh my God, this is brutal and racist. But you're taking the specific case that happened. And as bad as it is, it exists in a context. And you can't ignore the context that, first of all, we had terrible, terrible terror attacks in Israel that left the population here really traumatized. Okay? Like, honestly, what do you think happens when someone screams Allah Akbar on the bus on line 5? That happened, I think, 2 years ago. He didn't have a bomb, nothing, but people just ran away from the entire street. Okay? And yeah, people are traumatized by it. And also, I think it's important to remember that it is unfortunate and I'm unhappy about the situation, but in the Arab communities in Israel, there is a much higher percentage of crime than the Jewish communities. For example, honor killings. If you take the amount of women that have been murdered, I think it was last year
That's
or something like that.
That's another protest that just occurred.
I think it was last year that the all, I mean, not all women, obviously, but many women in Israel decided to take a day off in a protest about violence against women.
Most of them now, in the Arab society, which
yes,
is very important
because
to say.
23 women were murdered, okay? But 21 of them were Arab. And a lot of them are being murdered because, you know, she was forced to marry her second cousin and she doesn't want to marry him and she runs away and then they find her and they kill her.
It's so very important for me, though, to say that we are not generalizing the whole Arab society. We're talking about an overview of how things are here. And I agree with Tom saying we need to look at the context.
Yeah, of course, it's not all Arabs, but statistically, it happens a lot more in the Arab
and
community.
And then we need to ask why, which is getting more interesting, because this is where I think if there is a place that there is a racist policy, it when it comes to budgets, okay? And this is exactly what we should talk about. We kind of overview the problem, okay? We have brutality against Arabs in a way, and then we're saying, well, it's because there is a problem of terror. Well, it's also because they have a lot of violence in their communities. Why do they have violence in their communities? Why isn't there enough enforcement there? Why is the education there is really low and their starting point in life is lower than others? And by the way, I think this is kind of comparable to what's going on in the States. How much do you invest in low socioeconomical communities and why we're not investing them enough? And
well, you're 100% right.
A policy that is a bit racist because the way that they divide budgets in the government are not equally for Jewish facilities and non-Jewish facilities. And I know that there are a lot of Jewish Knesset members that are working very, very hard to make sure that it's fixed. So
yeah,
yes,
and it should be fixed.
A lot of things to improve of, a lot of things to work on. But I think that what Daniel is talking about is something that's like the tip of the iceberg, right?
Yeah.
And we could definitely take deeper question to understand and say, is it a policy racism, or it's just people racism, or it's police racism? But it's that's why I think it's not comparable, okay, in a way.
I'll tell you this. I think that you're right. The police brutality we see against Arabs is the tip of the iceberg, or the tip of the iceberg, and underneath the surface there's a lot of, or even a pyramid, right? The base of the pyramid is some institutionalized racism in terms of budgets and things like that, and also the mistreated Arab communities, and that causes crime, which causes deep police brutality and causes the image of black people as troublemakers. Arabs as troublemakers, again in quotations. That's the image, and that causes harsh and violent police reaction against them, and yeah, you're right. That's what I'm saying is that's actually the base, and that's actually but it's all part of the same.
It's underlying, but
it's
I just have to say.
Hold on, one second. I'm sorry. It's all part of the same phenomenon, and I do want to comment to the context. What you talk about the context. I am looking at the context. I'm not overlooking the context at all. I think it's important, and it's important that you're here to say it because the context is important. But still, I would like to see a more harsh reaction inside the Jewish community here against these kind of things, and it's very nice and it's very important where people here talk about BLM and talk about police brutality against black communities in the United States, but it's even more important for us as Israelis who live here to acknowledge we have the same problems locally, mm-hmm. and not say, no, it's because of terror, it's because of this, because of that. No, it's because of racism, it's because of some institutionalized racism, it's because of the entire thing we just talked about, which is just one phenomenon of mistreating minority communities here.
I think that yes, there is some truth in what you say. I think actually you both are overlooking a huge problem within the Arab societies in Israel, because it's not just lack of budget, because there are many poor Jewish towns as well in Israel, and of course when there is poverty there is much more crime. But if you go to a society like, for example, certain Bedouin tribes in the south of Israel, in the Negev Desert, that don't recognize the state of Israel. And for them, to stop smuggling weed or cocaine or women trafficking from Egypt into Israel just because the government says so.
You're talking about extremely rare cases. No,
it's not. No, it's not extreme rare cases. This happens, and there are more guns in the Arab side of Lod, which is a mixed Jewish Arab city, than the police station has. Okay, and that is a huge problem, and you both are completely ignoring it.
Yeah, I think that's. But it's, we're not ignoring it. It's a very niche topic. I agree with you, Tom, but I think it's a very niche topic, and I think something else to add to the mix of complications about. What you're talking
about. We just talked about what you said, Ken. Yeah. We just talked about what you said, which is we're not ignoring it. I think it's all part of the same phenomenon of lack of budgets, lack of proper education. I think that the specific Bedouin communities you're talking about, that's not what we're talking about. I'm talking about Arabs who live in large Arab cities or large Jewish cities like Haifa. And like Lod and Ramle and other places like that, who are mixed cities, huge cities, has a big Arab community, a big Jewish community, and these cities, I think, the communities in these cities, I think, they're harshly mistreated, police brutality, and the other topics we're talking about, but it's all the same thing.
I'm going to conclude from my end a little bit about this topic. Yeah. I think that. Before I conclude, I think that there's another aspect that we kind of ignored, which is an identity complexity for Israeli Arabs. Okay, don't forget that there's the identity thing about, do they feel Israelis as we feel Israelis? Do they feel part of the society? If they don't, how does it affect the way they see this place? Do we see them as part of our society, and how does it affect? And in a way, maybe the comparison that is being made to what's going on in the States, towards what's going here with the Israeli Arabs, and this is very, very hard, important to you started with this very good differentiate between those two populations, is that minorities and the way we treat them as society is in a bad place all over. The only component that is different than what's going here is that we have a terror aspect to it, and it's about security. And maybe one of the results that we, you know, things are going here a little bit more strict when it comes to policies and I don't want to say police brutality, but stopping people that look suspicious, is because there's a very solid claim of history here that is problematic.
Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah, that's the context.
But
it's okay.
I do, after listening to both of you and kind of thinking what I said, I really think that looking deeper at how we look at different minorities and what we invest or don't invest as a society in it and how much do we fight and stand for them is very important. And this is a lesson that I take from this conversation as well.
Yeah.
And definitely.
Yeah. I think that's the lesson to maybe take into consideration that we have the same problem here, and maybe we can do something about it. Maybe we should. Maybe we could even care, you know, because I think most people don't care.
I think. I mean, personally, me, most of my friends, most of the people that I talk about with this, that I talk with about the subject, they do care. The main conclusion that we arrive to is that. Yes, of course, the budgets have to be equal. Yes, there needs to be proper policing so that, you know, you catch the bad guys, basically, and allow the community to thrive. And also, as what Eden said, it's true. I think it's difficult what I'm about to say, but it's a choice that every Arab living in Israel has to make. Are they part of the society or are they not part of the society? And that's something that we also need to decide. How are we treating them? Are we treating them as part of our society? Or are we saying, no, they're Arabs, they can be on the side?
Or are we creating the good structure to make them feel part of the society? And we have a long way to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have a long way to go.
I think that everybody deserves respect. Even if they don't want to be part of the Jewish society, they can have they can have their own
word on that.
They can live in their own world. But they should receive the same rights that everybody receives as part of the law here as Israeli citizens. Bro, wow. I don't know. This is...
Welcome to Israel.
I feel like I need to, you know...
But this is a typical conversation over hummus, you know?
Yeah, like, it is typical. These are actually typical conversations we have here.
Yeah, a lot. I'm usually right, so... No,
You could say that, I guess, I suppose.
If you want to listen to more typical conversations from Israelis, please subscribe.
And comment your thoughts.
I missed you guys. It was really good.
It was fun. It was really good.
Yeah, it was fun. When is the next lecture?
When we click end.
Bye, guys.
I'm serious. Is there a next lecture?
The next one? Whoever wants, they can contact me on Ask Tom About Israel. Doing it. It's for free.
Our website here, or they can send a message.
Absolutely. I'm doing it. It's completely volunteer, so I'm doing it for free. And I'd love to, you know, help as many people as I can understand Israel better.
Sweet as, bro.
Sweet as. All right, guys, was an absolute pleasure.
It was.
All right. It was. It really was. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
I'm not touching hands at this time.
Elbows, high five.
So thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Yalla, bye.
Bye.